Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. No surprise, we'll stay very hot through the rest of this afternoon around the valley. In fact, that excessive heat warning stays with us until 8 o'clock tonight. And then for tonight, we'll have clear skies, lows around 80, and then relatively cool for the next couple of days. Highs still above normal, sunny in 107 tomorrow, and then sunny in 108 on Wednesday. Currently with relative humidity at 6%, it's mostly clear and 106 degrees. An employee of Dignity Health in Chandler is suing the healthcare provider for not covering his gender transition treatment. KJZZ's Will Stone reports the American Civil Liberties Union filed the suit in U.S. District Court today.
Joe Robinson works as an operating room nurse at Chandler Regional Medical Center and incurred thousands of dollars in medical expenses after his employer refused to cover his medical treatment for gender dysphoria. This led Robinson to file a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which found reasonable cause to believe that Dignity's insurance plan discriminates on the basis of sex. According to court documents, Dignity Health responded to Robinson's complaint by saying its denial was not discriminatory because its plan offers no benefits for, quote, personality disorders, including gender identity as well as behavior and impulse control disorders. Gender dysphoria is not, however, considered a personality disorder by the medical community, says the ACLU, and denying transgender employees such doctor-prescribed treatment constitutes a violation of the Civil Rights Act and the Affordable Care Act. Dignity Health did not immediately respond to requests for comment about the lawsuit. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Muhammad Ali was once known as the world's most famous person, but he was also a neighbor who leaves a big footprint in Arizona as a Valley resident for a couple of decades. Ali died in Scottsdale on Friday night. His body was sent back to Louisville for funeral services later in the week, and KJZZ's Phil Latzman covered the story this weekend. Phil, I remember seeing Ali not at his best in the ring. I think the first fight I was allowed to watch of Ali was against Larry Holmes, and Ali was kind of punch drunk. So it's really fun being guys about the same age to remember him floating like a butterfly, stinging like a bee, and just doing these really entertaining things on top of being a boxer.
Yeah, a lot of people just don't remember that Muhammad Ali. And as a kid, my memory was imitating Howard Cosell and Muhammad Ali interviewing each other. Sometimes I would have my friend do the Ali part. Sometimes I would do both and just sit in my garage and imitate them. So it was a huge part of both of our lives. I think being of the same middle-agedom, Muhammad Ali was a big part of our sports lives and lives in general.
And we were very lucky here in the Valley. Ali may have been a citizen of the world, but he was one of us for the past couple of decades.
The Islamic community of Arizona gathered last night in Tempe to honor his faith and remember him locally as a valued member of our community.
He taught non-Muslims that Muslims are regular people. You know, we're your neighbors, we're your doctors, we're your attorneys, we're your athletes. This was a person who went to sporting events and went to charity events and raised children and raised grandchildren, all at the same time as while testifying to the oneness of God and believing in the last messenger.
He wanted people to come together. He didn't want to hurt anyone. That's why he didn't want to go to the Vietnam War, for example. So anyone who will take a stand for the right, it just melts my heart. It makes me so proud. And as an attorney, as an African-American, as a Muslim woman who wears hijab, he gave me a lot of strength.
That was Ghassan Awad and Zarina Nadir, who were among the scores of people from all different faiths who attended the ceremony at the Islamic Center of Tempe. Ali came here in the 1990s for treatment of Parkinson's disease and helped found and put his name on the Parkinson's Center at the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix. He split his time between his hometown of Louisville, a summer home in Berrien Springs, Michigan, and here in Scottsdale, where he did spend much of his time. Ali teamed with local businessman Jimmy Walker for the annual Celebrity Fight Night charity event, which raised millions of dollars each year for Barrow and helped it grow from a facility treating 60 patients a year to one that now exceeds 10,000. In fact, the last time a frail Ali appeared in public was at the Celebrity Fight Night charity event in April. And this weekend, I spoke with Jimmy Walker about the legacy Ali leaves here in our world.
I founded Celebrity Fight Night, and the Muhammad Ali Parkinson Center is at Barrels, and it's been there for about 20 years. In the beginning, before we did this with Muhammad Ali, they were seeing probably about 60 patients a year. Now we're at 10,000, and a lot of credit to Muhammad Ali. His name, his reputation, and so it's one of the large Parkinson centers at Barrows here in Phoenix. Muhammad, his goal was to find a cure for Parkinson's disease, and so hopefully that's going to happen soon, but they're just making progress, but we're still going to keep working the game.
It was quite a fight. I mean, 32 years he fought Parkinson's disease, and it beat him in the end, but he fought it so valiantly for so long. Can you describe what it was like to see him year after year and to be around him here in Phoenix and see him struggle with this?
Well, year after year, the Parkinson's took a toll on him. In the very beginning, he would be on stage and he would present the awards and he would share some things, but each year took a little bit of a toll. He actually came to the last event. The last public event he attended was April 9th at Celebrity Fight Night. He was next to Carrie Underwood, our headliner. He was just there just out of competing, fighting it and everything. He wasn't well, he was ill, but that's the champion that he is. He was right there with us.
Can you describe, for those who don't know, his connection to Arizona, why he was here, why he lived in Scottsdale? I know it had to do with his illness, but the connection to us here in the Valley.
Well, that's pretty simple. He started coming to Celebrity Fight Night in 1998 when we got it started. And he felt the warmth of the people here, and he fell in love with the Valley like so many people. But it was a natural, too, because his doctor, Dr. Abe Lieberman at Barrows, it was close, the proximity. But he decided they'd keep, he and Lonnie, their home in Louisville. They'd keep their home also in Barron Springs. So he's a resident. He'd go to restaurants. I took him to many Phoenix Suns games, and it's amazing. I take him to the Suns games. There might be 18,000 people there, and two-thirds of them would stand up, give him a standing ovation when he walked into the arena. And then players on both sides of the team, they'd come up and say, hey, just want to shake your hand, champ. And we'd walk out, and would you believe he'd get another standing ovation? I mean, no athlete, no entertainer can walk in a room and leave a room and get a standing ovation but Muhammad Ali.
For somebody that knew him on a personal level, can you describe him? For those who, most of us, who never had the chance to spend much time with him, what was he like personally?
Well, his legacy will go down as the greatest boxer ever lived, perhaps the greatest athlete that ever lived. And his charisma and the rope-a-dope and all the things he said, but the quote I will always remember that he said was that the greatest religion in the world is the religion of love. And we know among faith, hope, and love, the greatest gift is love. But he lived it. He showed love for the sick, for the homeless, for the elderly, little children. So the legacy I remember is the warmth he had and the kindness for people. And hopefully that'll transcend, that people get the feeling, the spirit of Muhammad throughout the world. Because we're living in a troubled world today with a lot of hatred and fighting. And I think if Ali was in good health like 20 years ago, he'd be in the Middle East right now. And he would make a difference. But let's hope people can resonate on the marvelous life he lived.
Will there ever be another athlete or person like him, or did they just mint one?
Just for the record, there will never, never be another Muhammad Ali. They don't make him like him anymore.
That is Celebrity Fight Night founder and close friend of Muhammad Ali's, Jimmy Walker. Steve?
And that's our own Phil Latzman. Phil, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you, Steve.
Muhammad Ali's presence in the Valley had a huge impact on Parkinson's disease research, especially at the Lonnie and Muhammad Ali Movement Disorder Center at the Barrow Neurological Institute. Dr. Holly Schill is director of the center. Dr. Schill, how measurable an effect did Muhammad Ali have on the center and Parkinson's advances?
The fact that he has given his name to the center has just had a tremendous impact on our ability to do the work that we're doing. Almost every day a patient will ask, you know, how is Muhammad doing, or have you seen Muhammad recently? And I think patients like the idea, you know, knowing that he was going through Parkinson's disease right along with them. So that's part of it. And obviously the tremendous philanthropy that came out of his name being associated with the Muhammad Ali Center allowed us to do the programming, do the mission that he and Lonnie really wanted us to do.
Is there certain progress you can tell us about that has been associated with, again, having some of that philanthropy over the last few years? I mean, are there things that have really allowed the research to progress or that you're allowed to serve more patients?
Right. So So when we started, there was really no programming for people with Parkinson's disease. People were given a diagnosis, handed a prescription, and said and told, you know, we will see you again in 6 months. And Lonnie and Muhammad came to us and said, we want more than that. We think patients deserve better than that. And really, that's been our focus for the last nearly 20 years. We provide patients with education around the time of diagnosis with respect to the symptoms. We get them involved in the community, get them involved in exercise programs, which we are now realizing is really critical to the progression of Parkinson's disease.
How much progress do you think has been made over the past decade or so?
Well, yeah, so I've been working in Parkinson's disease for nearly 20 years, and I have really seen quite a bit of progress in terms of what we know about Parkinson's disease. For instance, we're learning a lot more about how it starts, how it progresses over time, and really what the basic biology of Parkinson's disease is. This has allowed us to develop treatments that I think really do improve the day-to-day quality of life in people living with the disease. We still desperately need therapies that really meaningfully slow progression. But even the treatments that we have available currently do have an impact on people's day-to-day functioning.
Dr. Holly Schill is director of the Lonnie and Muhammad Ali Movement Disorder Center at the Barrow Neurological Institute. In order to make a lot of progress on curing diseases, financial donations are needed. Does having a famous person with the disease and who is willing to talk about it help with fundraising? To learn more, I'm joined by marketing professor Deborah Small of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Small, does it in fact help with raising money if a celebrity is attached to an illness?
Absolutely. And the reason, so we wrote a paper, we did some research several years ago in which we looked both observationally, and also we ran experiments to try to understand the impact of having personal experience with a particular misfortune on sympathy and charitable giving towards other victims of the same misfortune. So, for instance, if you happen to have somebody in your family or a friend or something like that who suffered from, say, you know, pick any disease, lung cancer, say, that personal experience with that particular misfortune leads to a dramatically higher likelihood that you will, in the future, support causes associated with lung cancer. So that being said, to come back to your initial question about Muhammad Ali, if you think about celebrities, they're kind of like all of our friends. Like, we all kind of personally know them, and even though they don't know us, we know them, and we connect to them, we sympathize with them. And so whereas, you know, the people that I know are different from the people that you know, and so forth. So we all have our own kind of social networks that are influencing the sympathy we feel towards different causes. When it comes to celebrities, they're kind of part of all of our social networks. We all are connected to them, and so we all can relate and connect when they go through something. So that's a big part of the psychology here, is that we simply empathize with others who are going through experiences that we can personally relate to because we've experienced them ourselves, or we've experienced them vicariously through friends and relatives of ours.
Is it important that the celebrities themselves have had some personal tie to it? In any way, would that impact whether people are more willing to donate or be involved or have their heartstrings pulled, as opposed to actually someone like Michael J. Fox, Muhammad Ali, who actually is experiencing the disease himself?
I think they're versions of the same, but it's definitely a much stronger version when the actual celebrity that people know is suffering in some way, and we're kind of witnessing, you know, that suffering through seeing them on TV and reading about them in the news. It's probably just a stronger version of the same sort of thing.
Marketing professor Deborah Small of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. There are three finalists to be the next Phoenix Police Chief: Mike Kurtenbach, Peter Newsom, and Jerry Williams. And tonight at 6 in the Phoenix City Council chambers, they'll be answering questions from Phoenix residents. To learn more about the forum and the possible questions, I'm joined by Assistant City Manager Milton Dehoney. Milton, residents were able to submit questions in advance via email and phone. What have you heard so far?
Yes, we have received about 100 questions submitted online by the public. We've also received some questions via voicemail. And then this evening, for people who want to attend the community forum, they'll have the opportunity to fill out question cards when they get there. and we'll use some questions from the audience as well.
So at this stage, could you characterize for us what topics seem to be of most interest to the public?
There's a lot of questions about community policing. There's a number of questions about collaboration, how police work with the community, work with organizations, work with institutions. We've had a variety of questions regarding body cameras, and also several questions about how police deal with the people who have mental health issues.
So how is this going to work tonight? I understand the three finalists are going to be there. With the three finalists in front of the public, however many people may show up, is there going to be a situation where people who are submitting questions today, will those be asked by a representative of the city of Phoenix? Will a person be allowed to ask the question him or herself?
This evening's community forum will be a moderated session. We have someone who will be moderating the entire activity, and so they will be reading questions that are written on cards. And so if someone comes this evening and they want to submit a question, we have a process for taking that question. We'll see if we can work it into the queue, and time permitting, the moderator will ask one or all of the panelists to respond to it. Given the fact that we've had already 100 questions submitted and we'll have more coming in this evening, not every question will be able to be asked, but we're confident that there'll be a good array of questions, and all of them coming from the community.
How big a part of the whole process is this, the final choice of the chief? Is this one of those things where, yes, you want public input, you want the public to be involved, but this may or may not actually impact with the final choices?
Well, we have designed a process where the public has been involved from the very beginning. So going back to last November, the public gave us input to help shape even what the job announcement was going to look like. They let us know what kind of characteristics and qualities they wanted in the chief, and so that shaped the way we did the search. So tonight's event is very important in the overall process. It's one step among many, but it is valuable nonetheless.
Will the public have a chance to come up and speak with the chief candidates after the event is over? Will there be some milling about, some, lack of a better term, schmoozing?
There will be an opportunity at the end of the forum tonight. We're going to have an informal reception in the lobby of City Hall, where all three finalists will be there along with their spouses. And so anyone that attends the forum that wants to mingle with them, to talk informally with them, they will have that opportunity.
Milton Dahoney, Assistant City Manager for the City of Phoenix. We've been talking about tonight's Police Chief Forum. Milton, thanks for the time.
Thank you for having me.
For a more specific perspective on tonight's forum, I'm joined by Will Gaona, Policy Director for the ACLU of Arizona. Will, what do you want to hear tonight at the forum, and what issues should be prioritized?
Well, we're hoping that it's a forum that actually, you know, addresses community concerns and really dives into some of the tougher topics like racial profiling or, you know, excessive use of force. And, you know, at the end of the day, the police chief serves the community, and so it's so important that the person be on record about some of these community concerns. And certainly those are some of the issues that we often hear about when talking to people about their interactions with police.
Is there any skepticism with this? You're hopeful that the city of Phoenix is really taking public concerns into account, but you're skeptical that they are taking as much into account as maybe they should.
Yes, I mean, certainly we're hopeful, and I think the city has, you know, at least ostensibly tried to involve the public in this process at various points. But, you know, I think we'll see tonight with the kind of questions that get asked, whether or not those are tough questions designed to really put these candidates on the record, or if there are more just opportunities for candidates to, you know, say some nice things to community members.
Are there inherent concerns that the organization has about Phoenix Police, or are some of the concerns more just with, in general, what some big American cities are dealing with?
I mean, I think you've identified, yeah, there are certain concerns that are concerns across the country with police departments. Certainly in Arizona with SB 1070, the way that different departments enforce that is of a concern to us. And you've seen in recent weeks, we've sent a letter to Tucson Police Department, for example, detailing problems with their enforcement of SB 1070. And so certainly we're hoping that's something that they'll address in the forum today, is for chief candidates who perhaps don't have that experience with dealing with state laws like SB 1070 that certainly implicate the constitutional rights of those that they'd be serving, you know, how are those candidates going to work to ensure that people's rights are protected on that issue?
And what about active communication? Once we actually have the next police chief in place, how important is it for that person to reach out to all ends of the spectrum of people in this community, whether it's ACLU or other groups?
It's extremely important, and it can't be something that just happens when this person comes on as chief. That's an ongoing process that, you know, the Phoenix Police Department should be continuously soliciting feedback from the community. Being responsive to the needs and desires of that community is extremely important.
Will Gaona is Policy Director for the ACLU of Arizona. We've been talking about tonight's Phoenix Police Chief Forum. The Valley's first Copa America Centenario match fell on the third straight day of record-breaking heat, but that wasn't expected to keep football fans in predominantly Hispanic Maryvale from taking in the spectacle. So KJZZ's Matthew Casey set out from our West Valley Bureau to find them.
The United States is hosting the Copa America for the first time, and Mexico played Uruguay on Sunday at University of Phoenix Stadium. Like the Super Bowl and college football national championship game, organizers want to turn Copa America into a party. Fan Central is in Tempe, and there are free events at Westgate. But I wanted to know what's going on in Maryvale, a neighborhood that was once a symbol of post-World War II suburbia, but transformed in the 80s and 90s into an area that's about 75% Hispanic. Meet Rosa Pastrana, a local activist and my chaperone for the afternoon. Nobody knows Maryvale better than she does.
I keep an eye on the community, help it learn to reduce crime, and be more united.
Rosa's from Guerrero, Mexico, and she's helping me find fans who couldn't afford tickets or would just rather watch with friends.
We have to support Mexico.
The temperature spiked to 113 degrees about an hour before kickoff, baking Maryvale's crumbling asphalt like a cake someone forgot in the oven. Rosa and I head out to find a party, but the oppressive heat is keeping everyone indoors. When she spots a full parking lot at El Cora restaurant, we go inside. The five-piece band belting out tunes makes El Cora feel like it could be a Mexican sports bar. We're led to a table surrounded by televisions. Juventino Martinez sits next to us. He drove to Maryvale from Chandler to see the match. More than anything, we came here because the food is fresh, he says. Martinez and I watch as Mexico jumps out to an early lead. Originally from Durango, Mexico, he's lived here for about 25 years. Martinez says the Copa America is a triumph for all of the countries that participate. It's great that they came to play in Phoenix. It's a big thing for Arizona when it comes to fans buying tickets, food, etc., he says. When we got to El Cora, the dining room was almost full, and it looked like it would only get busier. But as the first half wanes, people take off, and pretty soon there are plenty of open tables. So at intermission, Rosa and I leave to find more fans. We head to another restaurant she knows on Thomas, but there's hardly anyone there. When the second half starts, we're cruising the heart of Maryvale searching for soccer fans.
La radio de la Copa America Centenario.
We go to get raspados, or snow cones. With scorching temps, it seems like a place where fans might gather. The match is on inside, but no one seems to be watching. We get back in the car and Uruguay scores. It's starting to look like the match may be a draw, but as we walk into Los Reyes de la Torta, Mexico retakes the lead. Eloy de la Torre owns Los Reyes de la Torta, which was featured on the show Man vs. Food. Originally from Mexico City, de la Torre says the restaurant was busy before the match, but slowed down once it started.
Pero sabemos que acabando el juego, va a regresar la gente a cenar.
But we know that when the game is over, people will come back for dinner, he says. As de la Torre and I chat, Mexico scores again in stoppage time to end the match 3-1. Imagine the excitement we have right now. To beat Uruguay, a team with guys that play for super teams in Europe, hopefully Mexico can keep it up so we can make it to the finals, he says. The heat may have kept fans from flooding Maryvale restaurants, or perhaps crowds were smaller because this is a blue-collar neighborhood and many people work on Sundays. But if Mexico keeps winning, Maryvale might turn into Football Central. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Today we continue our celebration of the working life. We're looking at the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. We're thinking about the jobs around the valley that might not be what you expect. Today, it's the City of Phoenix street sweepers. You see them driving slowly on the freeways and in neighborhoods, cleaning up dirt. The trucks have two steering wheels, and most operators drive on the right side of the vehicle.
Hi, my name is Jaime Garcia. I'm a motor broom operator, equipment 3.5, for the City of Phoenix. Today we'll be on 35th Avenue from Lower Buckeye to Broadway, doing gutter brooms, picking up dirt in the middle of the roads. It's a 10-hour day shift, so it's pretty long. That's lowering the back end of the broom, the pickup broom. The speed limit is usually from 5 to 8 miles an hour. If you go any faster than that, you're not really picking up any debris. All you're doing is shooting it all over, and it's not really doing any good. If you're going too fast, the water, the spray system doesn't hit the asphalt, and all you're doing is making dust. See how the cutter room is shooting it into the middle, and then the back pickup room is literally pushing it onto a conveyor belt, and that conveyor belt takes it all the way to the hopper. Yeah, that's where all the debris goes in. I'm a car support driver, so we dump our debris into a 551-556. Hey, can you meet me on 36th Avenue and Vineyard?
This is 10-4, 36th Avenue and Vineyard. You can call
him. All right, 10-4. Yeah, he's on his way.
My name is Ralph. I'm the support driver. They call me, I go to their location, they drive, dump into me, then I go to the next driver, so I get full and I go to the landfill, and then I start the process all over again.
I mean, there's just so many challenges every day that every day is different. There's areas where it is so bad out there. When you finish with that neighborhood, you cruise around to see what you missed, and you see that neighborhood clean, looks nice, and then you have citizens coming out there stopping. Yeah, sometimes they want to give you sodas, but we can't accept sodas or anything. They're just so happy. It really brings out happiness in you, so I like doing it. I do.
That's Jaime Garcia sweeping the streets in South Phoenix. We'll have more about somebody's job next week. Good afternoon. In KJZZ News at 2:36, Grand Canyon National Park has earned provisional status as an international dark sky park. From the Arizona Science Desk, Melissa Sivany reports for KJZZ.
The designation is awarded by the International Dark Sky Association to places that combat light pollution. Officials have 3 years to retrofit Grand Canyon National Park's light fixtures. It will then join 5 other dark sky parks in the state. Jane Rogers is the Deputy Chief for Science at Grand Canyon National Park. She says the designation is an opportunity to educate 5 million visitors annually about dark skies.
Much of our wildlife at Grand Canyon is nocturnal and really relies on clear and high-quality night skies for navigating and pollinating and foraging. And in addition to that, what we're also looking at is energy efficiency and cost savings through better and more improved smart lighting.
Currently, less than half of the Grand Canyon's 5,000 light fixtures meet the criteria for dark sky-friendly lighting. The National Park Service plans to bring that number to 2/3 by 2019. I'm Melissa Sivany in Flagstaff.
A lack of corporate headquarters has been a sore subject for a number of years in the Valley. How could the area increase its business diversity without having companies from different industries doing significant hiring here? One small step in that direction was announced late last week, with the Switzerland-based Kadelski Group deciding to put its North American headquarters in Phoenix. Eric J. Told, the Phoenix Business Journal, has done extensive reporting on the Kadelski move and joins me to talk about it. So, Eric, why did Kadelski choose Phoenix?
Kadelski is a global technology company with a really strong cyber footprint. Mm-hmm. And what they discovered is that in Europe, their growth stagnated. So strategically, they knew they had to get into North America. This is the market for cybersecurity. They did research on their own before pinning it down that they wanted to come to the American West. And they essentially looked at the Bay Area, Denver, and Phoenix. So they had already made their short list before they even knocked on the door of the United States. Mm. Phoenix put together, in under a month, a whirlwind tour to bring their executives in. They met with the governor. They met with the mayor. And the big thing that their CEO, Rich Fennessy, told me is that meeting with the governor and the mayor gave them a really high comfort level that they could make this move. Now, we're talking about bringing about 150 families from Switzerland to Phoenix. Plus, over the next 3 years, they're going to hire about 250 additional people.
So when Kadelski was looking at Bay Area, Denver, and Phoenix, you know, there's been talk, obviously, in the past about what sort of incentives are built into some of these things. As far as you know, did Kadelski ask for anything in particular, or is it more what you've said about being impressed by what's going on here?
Phoenix has this under-the-radar hub of cybersecurity technology companies, and there's some big players here that nobody knows about. Some of it comes out of the AZ Labs in Mesa. A lot of it comes out of SkySong at ASU. They knew that they would have a workforce, a qualified workforce to draw upon. They also wanted to be in an environment with a good business operating environment and just a good place to live. When you talk about incentives, Kadelski and really all good companies today, they don't ask for incentives. Incentives are used to take the cost difference off the table.
Who closed the deal on this? There's GPEC, of course, Arizona Commerce Authority. You mentioned the governor involved. How does a deal like this ultimately get closed?
The project came in the door to GPEC, so they're the ones who handle it. But this is a team effort. Phoenix has to sign off on it. ACA has to sign off on it. GPEC actually doesn't allocate any of the money. So they don't have a regulatory process with it. But the collaboration that exists between the agencies is amazing. And they each have their own niche in what they do. GPEC was the marketing people. They put together the business case. They made the sales calls. They brought the company to town. Arizona Commerce, that's the money. And they did the financial assessment. And what is Arizona going to get out of this?
Eric J. Toll covers the economy for the Phoenix Business Journal. Eric, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
The cybersecurity field in the Valley has been trying to boost its profile. For more on that, we turn to Ori Eisen. He's CEO of the Scottsdale-based startup firm Trusona and a board member of Security Canyon, which is working to attract and retain cyber talent in Arizona. And Ori, how big of a deal is it to the cybersecurity industry in the Valley that Kadelski Group is coming here?
I think this is amazing because if we show the world that once companies move here, they can get better access to education, better talent, great weather, we can have a hub here in our area that the whole world will know that cybersecurity and internet security are growing here in our area. And for this company to move here just shows that we're already making some waves, but it will only get better if all of us will tout the same horn.
Is this company a big enough player in the field to have that kind of impact?
Many people might not know the name. However, in the cybersecurity space, specifically in Europe, they are a growing powerhouse. I think the whole idea of coming here to the United States is to have a foothold and grow the brand here as well.
What do you think it was about Phoenix that led this company to come here as opposed to any number of other places they could have come if they wanted to be in the U.S.?
As you know, we have here in town a group of companies that banded together called Security Canyon. And all of us can tell you the reason we like it here is probably the same reason this company is moving here. The cost of doing business in other hubs, let's just say Silicon Valley, is just enormous. The house prices, the commute every day is really, really bad. So if you are a company that wants to be in this business and you can pick Austin or Silicon Valley or Washington State, like in the Seattle area, all those places are so crowded and so expensive that once you start looking beyond that, Phoenix becomes a great place, both because it's closer to the West Coast, has great weather, and has enough talent here and some unique capabilities here in the state that it's worth putting your stakes in the ground here.
What do you think ultimately will be the impact, besides maybe the idea of adding some prestige and putting this industry on the map here? What other kind of practical impacts do you think this move might have?
That's a great question. I want you to look at this from the viewpoint of a person who wants to come get a job in Phoenix. if we only had one or two companies in the space, clearly a couple who's looking to get out of the big city into suburbia will say, we can move to Phoenix, but if it doesn't work out, we don't have a lot of options. Every single time another company comes here, the ideas about can I move to Phoenix, can I do this, and have enough companies to move around just becomes easier and easier. I think that is the higher level note of the news. It's not that just this one Swiss company came here, is that we are adding more and more opportunities for people to just move their life here, and that is what we should all strive for.
It sounds like you're saying it kind of makes it safer for more in the industry to relocate here.
Absolutely safer, and also it's a virtuous cycle. Look, investors do not want to give money to a company that is all alone in its industry in a town. But once you see that there is more and more companies, it's much easier to give money for new businesses. It's much easier for students who finish here at ASU to stay here as opposed to run, get a job at Google somewhere. And the whole thing will just start helping the economic development. So I want you to think about it as this one company moving. The news is that there's a trajectory, and if we will just keep doing it, we will have a great economic development here in town.
Ori Eisen is CEO of TruSona. Ori, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are more than 19,000 children in foster care in Arizona. It's a number that keeps growing in our state, despite the money and resources being poured into the state's child welfare system. So why do these numbers keep going up, and is Arizona doing enough about it? To tackle those questions, I'm joined by the show's Lauren Gilder. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Steve.
So I understand there's a national conference here in the Valley starting today looking at these issues with the child welfare system and trying to find some solutions.
That's right. It's called the National Citizen Review Panel, and it's hosted by Arizona State University's Center for Child Well-Being this week. And the people who are coming to attend are from the industry, but most of them are volunteers who actually give their time serving on what's called citizen review panels that are charged with evaluating child welfare systems in states across the country.
And what exactly are these citizen review panels?
So here in Arizona, we have three of them in different regions throughout the state. They meet four times a year, evaluate the state's child welfare system, and issue a report on it every year that goes to the legislature and the State Department of Child Safety. And it's actually a requirement that we have these citizen panels.
The federal government actually legislates that states, in order to receive their funding, have to have citizen involvement in child welfare.
That's Judy Krysik. She's the director of ASU's Center for Child Well-Being, and she says the volunteers on these panels look at the child welfare policy and practices, review them, make recommendations for improvement, and she says they're an important way to make sure the state is held accountable for the money we put into the child welfare system.
Our state's child welfare system has had its share of challenges in the last few years. What does Krysik say about the fact that the numbers of children in foster care are still going up?
Well, she says that number, the 19,000 plus in our foster care system right now, includes grandparents and other family members that also take in a child, as opposed to just a traditional foster care situation. But she knows that number, that 19,000, is a huge challenge.
19,000 children in care would fill the whole Coyote Stadium. And the problem is the poor outcomes that sets up for children over their lifetime. Children who have been in care have poorer outcomes in terms of the job they will have when they are an adult, whether or not they will graduate. They're less likely to graduate, very much less likely to go on to college or university. And if they do, they're likely to drop out.
And does she think the state can do anything to help this?
She actually does, but she says it's going to take much more than the Department of Child Safety to do it. And she says that's where these citizen review panels come in. They can find programs that actually work and ones that don't, and they can advocate for the ones that work. I talked to her about all of this, but I started by asking her the question you just asked me, the big one. Why are these numbers so high here in Arizona to begin with?
We know some of the problems are related to substance abuse of the parents. We went through the meth epidemic and now we're into the opiates. In addition to that, it's sometimes very difficult for people who were never parented in the way they should have been themselves when they have children to know how to parent those children. And so that sets up for them a system where maybe then they lose a child into the child welfare system. They may have another child that goes into that system. Those children may grow up in that system and then have children, and they don't know how to parent those children.
It's about modeling?
It is. And we have to break that cycle.
So if a lot of this is about modeling and repeating that cycle, are there ways that the system and the state can intervene in parenting, can prepare parents better? Are there programs that work that way?
There are, and there are a lot of programs that work. So there are programs that teach parents how to parent, and the best of those programs are prevention. There are home visitation programs in the state. One of them is called Healthy Families Arizona. It's very successful. The problem is that over the years, with the budget, it expands and it contracts. And in 2008, we lost 75% of the funding for that program, and we lost a lot of other services that help families in addition to the Healthy Families.
But is it true, though, isn't it true, though, that we've, as a state, put more money into our child welfare system in recent years, and still those numbers are rising?
We have put in additional money, and it takes additional money to build up an infrastructure and to build up a program that is serving families in a way that they're not going to come back into the system. We don't want this revolving door. And so that takes money. But we need to look at what exists outside of the Department of Child Safety, because if all we have is the Department of Child Safety, that's not going to work. And so it takes all of these citizens and all of these agencies to work together in a coordinated way to serve children and families so they won't come into the child welfare system.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger talking with Judy Krysik, the director of ASU's Center for Child Wellbeing. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Musical talent is not something I'm intimately familiar with. I've played guitar poorly and have never thought about building my own instrument. But more than 2,000 people have done just that at the Roberto Venn School of Luthery in Phoenix, which is marking its 40th year of teaching what many call the art of guitar making. The school's director, William Eaton, has been there since its earliest days. He's also an award-winning guitarist in his own right. I visited the school and started by asking Eaton why making an instrument with his own hands is so special.
There are so many layers involved, Steve, from, you know, the personal touches you put into it, the vision you have of making the instrument, the emotions you go through, the sweat and tears you put into it, the desire to make an impeccable instrument, to make it better, to do the things you can do on a custom instrument that won't happen necessarily on a machine made. Not to say machine instruments are bad, it's just that the personality that gets embedded into this instrument comes from the soul of the maker, I believe, and it's really definable, and you can sense it. It's tangible.
So if it comes from the inside of someone and what that person is feeling about holding the materials in his or her hand, where does the instructor come in? How does the instructor guide the person to the right path?
Great question. Our instructors are growing along with our students, and every moment they spend with a student is a learning experience for them as well. They know a little more than the students do, obviously, and they are guiding them in that process. And the best they can do is kind of show them the way. And for the students, it's a journey. You know, they're following in a way, and yet every moment is something that's giving them more information about what a guitar is, what the theory is behind it, how it sounds. What do you do to the bracing, to the sides and the back, to the neck angles, the geometry of the instrument, to make it a better sounding instrument?
At what point did you feel like you had the right inspiration for what you were doing? And does it change to you over the years? Has there been, 10 years ago, did you have a different feel for something? Or is it each time you build a guitar, is it going to be somewhat different?
I think when you look at any artist's work, whether they be a musical instrument maker, an artist, a musician, a composer, you see a certain essence in their work. I know when I listen to Beethoven or Bach, I know who that is. The evolution of my instruments, now I'm working on, for example, a spiral series. They're all based on spirals, a Fibonacci spiral, this common shape that we see throughout the universe, and it's intrigued me for decades. And now I'm actually have these on my workbench. And how will that, you know, what will the sound be affected by the structural shape of a spiral? So you get these moments of inspiration day to day, moment to moment, year to year, and that changes over time. But I think innately there's something, at least in my design sensibility, that keeps it in a certain realm. And even though I've observed that from the outside and have wanted to change that, I don't know that you can. I don't know if you can completely get outside of yourself, but that is a challenge.
there's a gentleness to you, and there's a gentleness in many ways to the music that you produce. Does it take that kind of personality to feel sort of at one with the instrument, or have you had all kinds here?
All kinds, yeah, and that can be expressed. If we could also all of a sudden magically hear all the music of what everybody listens to out there, and during orientation we ask students to talk about what their music style, and we have everything from heavy metal and grunge to classical and delicate style music. So it definitely is a wide range of what you'd hear at the school, and that's great. That makes a real interesting collaboration, because I think the students learn perhaps as much from each other as they do the instructors. They get to watch each of these instruments getting built side by side, and so they have an opportunity to not just feel the bracing strength of one guitar, things 30 or 40 guitars, and see all these instruments come together. So that really helps the entire process.
I am John Lippi, also known as Juano Lippi. It's been life-altering, you know. I've sort of been a theoretically built instruments in my mind, you know. But, and also doing really technical music work in the studio and being an avid musician, I know about it, but you don't really know it until you do it. And that's kind of what they stress here. You don't know how to build a guitar until you build a guitar. And it sounds like sort of a lazy reason, but it's not. And what's beautiful about it is that it forces you into the now. You are really in the now, because there's certain things that you have to concentrate on while you're doing it that takes you out of the past or future. And it really hones you into what you're doing and the connection between mind, hand, and without having to sound too new agey or hippy dippy, body and soul, you know? So it's a cool thing.
Lippi is one of about a dozen students focused on creating their guitars. Each of them will build one acoustic and one electric. One of the older students is Mark Young. He's been a different kind of craftsman, focused on building cabinets and furniture.
It's really allowed me to be a little more expressive. You know, I've built a couple other guitars other than the student instruments, and I've built a lap steel that I made into like a 50s Art Deco rocket ship type of design, and inlaid moon and stars and stuff in the headstock to kind of keep with the space theme on it. And then I'm building a kind of a Les Paul Junior. I play a little bit. I'm not a great player, and if I could be a really good guitar maker, I'd be happy with that.
Scott Walker graduated from Roberto Van himself, has become a master guitar builder since, and comes back to the school as a special instructor. He says the craft combines art and engineering.
At first it was more about art, but as I went down the road, construction techniques and some few things, you know, trying to make something a little different, kind of continue the path of evolution of the instrument and try to add to the path, you know, instead of just kind of making the same old thing. So engineering part of it has become a big part of what I do now with some of the joints and different construction techniques. It's almost now that's my focus. So the art part of it is there now, but so now I'm kind of melting the two, yeah.
And for the school's director, William Eaton, Roberto Venn has turned into a safe creative haven for students and instructors alike.
I believe that now. If you'd asked me that same question when we started, I wouldn't have gotten that. But after 40 years, and we don't really talk about that. You know, when people come to the school, it's the same old idea of, well, you want to learn a profession. You're going to be a guitar maker, a repair technician. You're going to go on the road. You're going to get a job with Fender or Gibson or Martin or the main big companies or the small companies. That's what we talk about. And that's what their goal is. But there's something deeper, just that tactile sense, working with wood, working with the trees, being in that environment where they, you know, really feel something and they're in the moment.
William Eaton, director of the Roberto Venn School of Luthery in Phoenix. The school is marking its 40th anniversary. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.